PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today we'll find out how to make diamonds out of thin air. And we'll remember the late Stanley Kunitz, the poet laureate and devoted gardener. He gave us a tour around his garden a few years back when he was 95. But first,
we are in the middle of a war, one that's been going on forever.
That is Ian McKellen in the new Da Vinci Code movie, playing the villain Lord Teabing.
It would devastate the very foundations of mankind.
Not to be confused with Ian McKellen as the villain Magneto in the new X-Men movie.
Make no mistake, my brothers. The humans will draw first blood.
That's out next weekend.
Who will you stand with?
In X-Men 3, the bad guy mutants want to destroy the human race, whereas in the Da Vinci Code...
I think we should do everything not to allow it to be shown. As a Catholic, it is blasphemous.
In case you're not one of the tens of millions of people who've read the novel, Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code is based on the premise that the Catholic Church has spent the last 2,000 years trying to cover up the truth about Jesus, that he survived the crucifixion and married Mary Magdalene. The Vatican is calling for a boycott of the movie. Christian groups in America are more divided on how to respond. So many critics have spent so much time debunking the supposed factual bases of the Da Vinci Code. There are enough of these books now to fill a whole aisle in the bookstore. But isn't the novel and the movie supposed to be fiction?
People are using it to justify their suspicions that Christianity is based on a lie. And that's a bad thing. That's a sad thing, because there's no historical evidence that any of that is true.
Anne Rice is best known for her novels about unholy vampires, but last year she published a novel about Jesus called Christ the Lord, Out of Egypt. In the course of her work on that book, she says she encountered all the same research materials as Dan Brown, but came to a very different conclusion about the early history of the church.
If you know church history, there isn't that kind of organization on any level. I mean, people did not sit around a conference table in 400 AD and say, let's crush the eternal feminine. They didn't even know what it was.
Rice says she isn't taking issue with the book or the movie as a Christian. She objects to depictions of real organizations with living people like the Vatican and Opus Dei as evil. But she also says she understands why so many people are so drawn to the conspiracy story Brown has invented.
Most of life, for most of us, is meaningless. I mean, things happen at random. And I think there's always been a great desire on the part of historians and journalists and the media to try to find threads of meaning. So conspiracy theories are glorified versions of that, you know, because the random nature of life is pretty scary. And it's comforting to believe that things happen for a meaning and that there are connections.
I think Anne Rice is exactly right about that. Although to me, the tendency to believe in conspiracies and to strictly believe in religious narratives spring from the same impulse, trying to impose absolute clarity on an existence whose purposes and meanings are murky and mysterious. It's why fundamentalism of every stripe is so appealing to so many people, and why 60 million copies of the Da Vinci Code have been sold. But that's not why I'm going to see the movie this weekend. I just go to all Tom Hanks movies. The novelist A.M. Holmes, in her fiction, isn't set on rewriting the history of Western civilization. Her specialty is taking tranquil suburban American lives and twisting them into grand catastrophe. Take her short story from 1990 called Adults Alone. Mom and Dad smoke crack while the kids are away, then accidentally burn down the house. But somehow, as a reader, I never feel guilty about gawking at the train wrecks she creates. Often because they're such funny train wrecks. When the National Geographic offered to send A.M. Holmes anywhere in the world to write a book about it, she chose Los Angeles. And after her assignment was done, the city became the setting for Holmes' latest novel. It is called This Book Will Save Your Life. I asked her to read the novel's opening scene.
He stands at the glass looking out. The city spreads below him, blanketed in foggy slumber, low pressure. Clouds roll over the hills, seeping out of the cracks and crevices, as if the geography itself is sending smoke signals. Below him, far down the hill, a woman swims, her long brown hair floating through the water. Her suit is a beautiful bright red dot, a rare tropical bird in a pool of unnatural blue. Every morning she swims, crawls like an Olympian. He takes comfort in her swimming, in her determination, her rhythm and routine, and the fact that he is awake when she is awake. There is urgency in her stroke. She cannot not swim. She is his confidant, his muse, his mermaid. He is at the glass. Usually he is not here, not now. Usually he gets up and gets on his machine. He runs while she swims. He runs watching the electronic ticker tape go by, trading from a keyboard strapped to the treadmill, typing as he trots, placing bets, going long and short, seeing how far up and down he can go, riding an invisible electronic wave. Usually he usually. Everything today is not the same, and yet it is exactly the same, and it can never be the same again.
A.M. Holmes, reading from her new novel, This Book Will Save Your Life. You set the book in Los Angeles, very richly evoked. Was that a necessary geography and culture to tell this particular story?
Well, I think so. I also think, to me, Los Angeles really is in some ways the most American city in America right now. It is incredibly surrealistic. I also think the American dream really is thriving there. It still is the place where people go to make it, whether it's as a gardener coming from Mexico, as a wannabe movie star from Des Moines. I also fascinated, honestly, with the geography and the fact people keep saying, you know, we have the best weather here. I'm thinking, okay, let's see. You got your brush fires, your flash floods, your sinkholes. You know, it's really
But it's sunny.
It's apocalyptic yet sunny, which is kind of like the novel itself.
Did you find yourself consciously balancing in this book the satire and entirely earnest attempts to sketch a form of redemption?
I mean, I think on the one hand, it honestly kind of does it itself. I mean, I think there really are these kind of, I don't know, accidental interactions with people.
You mean like
really,
neighbors or people you happen to work with? Or?
All of the above. And people whose paths cross your own. And I actually think that's more and more what contemporary life is getting to be like. It's just a whole different kind of non-connective, connected world we live in.
All authors get good reviews and bad reviews. Before we began this interview, you were talking about a couple of the harsh ones that you received for this book. As you read those, which I presume you do, do you compose in your mind kind of responses?
You know, it's sort of funny because I have to say there's nothing about this book that made me think it would prompt like such a vitriolic kind of passionate hatred from some people. In some way, what it was a lesson to me is how surprisingly kind of naive and hopeful I could remain. Someone's called me, said, you know, the New York Times is reviewing your book 2 weeks ahead of the publication. And I remember feeling, I don't know, like a little in retrospect, like Sally Field, thinking, they must like me. They must really like me. So wrong. I don't know. I mean, I honestly think every book I've written, there's always been something. Either someone will say, oh, it's not as dark as she usually is, or, oh, she's gone really dark again. I mean, you can't win. But beyond that, I think, you know, I'm just, for lack of a better word, trying hard to do my job and do the best I can. And I hope people will, you know, read the book and decide for themselves.
And is there a novel in percolating already or not?
No, the next book is this memoir that's just about been killing me.
And why at your relatively tender age do you feel obliged to write a memoir?
You know, I had this very specific incident happen in my life, which is that I was adopted. And then these people came back and found me. And it was very disconcerting because it sort of was like I wasn't who I thought I was.
And is that revelation and that encounter have an ongoing ripple in your self-identity, or was it done and now you can write about it and that's that?
I think it has an ongoing ripple. I think the process of writing it, honestly, I would never do something like that again. It's sort of like doing surgery on yourself and then saying, God, muscles look really interesting up close. Wow, you're bleeding. I mean, just horrible. You know, on the other hand, I would say, in some way, I feel enormously stronger. Like, I think nothing can hurt me now because I really sort of, I don't know, bore the brunt of it in some way.
So this next book maybe did save your life.
Well, I
it's cute to say.
Right, exactly. I don't think it's, no. I think, you know what I hope is that I hope that people who've had similar sorts of struggles with just, it's not so much about adoptions, but sort of like disruption in their lives can kind of read it and think, there are many ways to get through this. And for me, part of it was ultimately much after the incident itself, going back and trying to sort of, I don't know, be almost like an electronic anthropologist and dig into it and try to figure out who were these people? And where did they come from? And Does it matter that I'm ultimately related to Roy Rogers? Or what is that? You know, just strange things.
Are you related to Roy Rogers?
Apparently I am related to Roy Rogers.
And Dale Evans as well?
No, just Roy. Because Dale would be, you know, not a blood relation. It's also about the weirdness of what does it mean, you know, who you biologically come from. And I found things that were just so fascinating. I found one guy who was, you know, with the same name as a relative. And there's one, you know, person who was a butcher on Second Avenue, and another person born the same year who died in Auschwitz. And when you don't know who you are, you're thinking they're both valid, they're both resonant. And what does that mean that one guy lives and one guy dies and they're sort of the same person?
And in the end, do you find that biological genetic connection meaningful or arbitrary?
Both. I mean, in that funny way. And I think now having the kid, which is the first person I've ever seen who's actually related to me, it's kind of amazing because I think, I know what she's thinking. And I think, no, you don't. So I have these little battles with myself. Yes, you do. You're the same. You're different. You know, but it is fascinating.
Ann Holmes, thanks very much for coming into Studio 360 today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up next, don't try this at home, making diamonds from gas.
I like to say about making diamond by CVD method is most of the things you can dream up doing are wrong.
Goodbye, cubic zirconium. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Hey, is this coal? Yes, I've run onto a little of it around here. Coal, carbon. Put it under 1,000,000 tons of pressure for 1,000 years and you've got a diamond. How we could use a diamond.
What to do? Call Superman. When that episode of the Superman TV show was broadcast in 1953, only Superman could make diamonds, with his bare hands, no less. Just a year later, though, scientists at General Electric replicated his feat in the laboratory. But scientists and artists are still pursuing the dream of making perfect gem-quality diamonds. Julia Barton has the story.
Diamond is the hardest material in the world. So how do gem cutters cut a diamond? The short answer is they hardly ever cut. They grind with other diamonds, using a wheel embedded with diamond grit.
And just turning the machine on, it's a mechanical purring, but that allows me to create my jewels.
New Yorker John Hattelberg is an artist and gemologist, meaning he's an expert in the chemistry and structure of minerals we know as gemstones.
I'm very alert to the fact that it's the process of my wearing the gem down to powder as it's breaking into light.
Hattelberg is best known for making exact replicas of famous diamonds, like the Hope Diamond at the Smithsonian and the 108-carat Kohinoor Diamond. That's the huge rock sitting in the crown of the Queen of England. This stone has a shady, even bloody history. India says the British basically stole it. But in the presence of big diamonds, Hattelberg says you forget everything else.
Diamonds are all about light. And when you increase the mass of that light, it can just be stunning. And certainly not just to look at them, but to hold them, which very few people get to do. And I've been very lucky to hold and fondle many of these stones. It's empowering.
Not that the artist is reverential about all diamonds. In fact, he's vaporized a few.
We took a 3-carat diamond crystal and we heated it up in a vacuum. And diamonds sublimate, which means they undergo a phase change. They skip a phase. So they go right from solid to gas.
Hattelberg sealed the vaporized diamonds in glass vials and called the sculpture Diamond Air. If that seems amazing, that diamonds can be easily vaporized, consider this. In laboratories around the world, scientists have just started doing the reverse. They're building diamonds from vapor, atom by atom.
This is where the future lies. Now we'll
go through this. Robert Linares is chairman of Apollo Diamond, a company in suburban Boston. They make reporters sign an agreement not to disclose the location. Maybe they don't want the neighbors to know that in this nondescript lab, diamonds are growing by the dozen.
This run has just started. It's only a few hours old, so you're seeing the raw seeds. Well, if you were to come in here in a few days, they would be a millimeter thick, and then they'd be 2 millimeters thick, they'd be 3 millimeters thick, and then they'd be 4 millimeters thick, and maybe you'd have 1-carat stones.
Linares grows his crop of diamonds with a process called chemical vapor deposition, CVD for short. Here's how it works. A small diamond, the seed, is placed in the bottom of a round vacuum chamber. Machines pump air out of the chamber and pump in hydrogen and methane gas. Then they use microwaves to heat the mix. When it hits 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit, the methane breaks down into hydrogen and carbon. The carbon atoms start to migrate down to the slightly cooler diamond seed and build more layers of diamond crystal. Or they could build layers of soot if you don't get everything exactly right.
I like to say about making diamond by CVD method is most of the things you can dream up doing are wrong. There's only a very narrow range of things that you can do that are correct.
Linares had been making optical crystals, like synthetic ruby laser lenses, for decades before he thought about trying to make diamond. He bought some basic equipment and first tried it out in his garage in the early 90s. He says his early results weren't much to look at, but he kept the image of a gleaming diamond in his mind.
I do think that a lot of success in science is like creating a piece of art. Because you have to become passionate about it. I think a lot of the failure in previous attempts to grow diamond was because people didn't have a passion about it. They didn't think out of the box. They didn't think about it creatively.
The raw diamonds go from the lab to gem cutters and then jewelers, who are making engagement rings and all kinds of jewelry with them. Apollo fully discloses that they make synthetic diamonds, and they even use the fact that they're not mined to help market the gems to those with environmental or political concerns about diamonds. But in the end, jewelry could just be a niche market for diamonds made with CVD. The research now is about using huge diamonds to do things like press gases into metals. People are dreaming about diamonds as computer chips and surgical instruments.
To me, it's very much like the way aluminum was 150 years ago.
Robert Hazen is author of the book The Diamond Makers.
One of the main uses of aluminum 150 years ago was for prize metals that were valued even more than gold or platinum. And yet today we use aluminum for everything because all you need is aluminum atoms, which are very common, and energy. Same thing with diamond now. All you need is carbon atoms and energy and you can make huge diamonds.
Right now most diamond jewelry is conservative because the material is relatively rare. So artists like John Hadleberg can't wait to get their hands on CVD diamonds. Not only could Hadleberg make his replicas out of actual diamond, he imagines the diamond finally busting the constraints of preciousness.
The future of synthetic diamonds won't just be relegated to being tennis bracelets. I think that there's something so powerful in both the history and the science of diamonds that artists and jewelers are going to find something to do with them that will be very, very interesting.
Hadleberg himself plans to be in on that interesting thing, but he won't say more. In fact, when it comes to CVD diamond, there's a lot of secrecy. Everyone admits the multi-billion dollar world of diamonds is on the cusp of a revolution, but no one knows yet who the winners and losers will be, so everyone's nervous. Apollo Diamond Chairman Robert Linares says they should just relax.
It's not like we have run a factory that was turning out hundreds of carats a day. That's not the case. They're still difficult to make. They're still cost more to make than a mined diamond. But down the road, of course, we expect that to be reversed.
But don't call Linares diamonds manufactured. He prefers to say custom-made and cultured diamond. Perhaps we'll all be using those words about diamonds someday to make them feel like something special. For Studio 360, I'm Julia Barton.
You can find out more about cultured diamonds, or whatever you want to call them, at studio360.org. I've just read a new collection of stories by the writer George Saunders called In Persuasion Nation. Saunders sets most of his fiction in a slightly desperate, more or less depressed America of the near future. Many of his stories have science fictional aspects, mainly new technologies for coercing people into buying stuff. In one story, advertisements are downloaded directly into teenagers' brains through a big socket in their necks. Horrific? Sure, but also extremely funny. And that combination pretty much describes Saunders' fictional world.
Well, you know, they never feel dark to me at the time. I always think I'm doing Chekhov. You know, it feels sort of humanistic. And then only later when I look at them again, I can sort of see that darkness. But I think I have kind of this idea that fiction is, to me, it's most interesting when it's on the worst possible day. You know, the day when everything goes to hell. Kind of like if you had Little Red Riding Hood, you know, if the story went, once upon a time, there was this girl named Little Red Riding Hood, and her mom said, don't ever talk to strangers. And she didn't. You don't have a story. So for me, my mind inclines to the kind of catastrophic, and with the thinking that if you could find the human in the moment of catastrophe, then you've really done something. That's actually when we're most sorely tested, and that's all. And it's also kind of funny. Someone falling down the steps is, I find it funny. And I grew up in Chicago, and
there, I can tell.
Yeah, from my melodious voice, but there. The most poignant moments and the most tragic moments, and no matter when you were feeling an excess of emotion, it was always expressed through humor, through sarcasm. Direct expression of emotion was kind of not what was going on there. And I think that got internalized in a way. So sometimes I think that humor is just the rather too abrupt statement of an obvious truth.
Did you grow up reading the black humor titans of my youth, and I assume some of your youth, people like Vonnegut and John Hawkes and all those guys?
I did later. I went to engineering school, so I didn't read anything contemporary at all until I was about 25 or 26. But I did, you know, Monty Python was a huge influence. My father and I would watch it, and he would, I remember just being so fascinated because he would laugh so hard he'd cry and then do the thing where he'd slide off the couch. And I thought, boy, that's power. You know, if these guys can make my dad cry and fall off the couch, that's really powerful. And then Mike Royko was a Chicago columnist who was writing at the time, and he had a real dark streak, really dark streak. So you
tried to do Saul Bellow as a Chicagoan, but couldn't quite pull off that naturalism?
You know, I didn't. Again, because I'm such an idiot, I didn't read Saul Bellow until really late in life. And my dad actually knew his brother. My dad was in the coal business, as was Bellow's brother. But somehow I didn't get to that stuff until really, really late. And so I had, when I was even 25 or so, I was in Asia in the oil fields, and I was surrounded by the most amazing material. You know, just crazy stuff. But because I hadn't read anything new, I had absolutely no way to express it. So I was kind of doing this, you know, Joseph Conrad on Quaaludes kind of thing that was so, it was dated, you know. So that was a real problem. I hadn't read anything contemporary, so I didn't have an idiom to express this kind of new stuff.
So you're a petroleum engineer in your mid-20s in Asia. How did you make the shift to being a very artful fiction writer?
It was very gradual, and I think I always loved writing, but I didn't have a sort of a cultural precedent. I didn't know how one would go about becoming a writer, so I would, you know, write in a journal, and I read a lot of the old timers, Hemingway I loved, and Fitzgerald, and even de Maupassant. I'd read those guys because we had them in our engineering library. That's all that there was. Thomas Wolfe.
So it's sort of the greatest hits of the early 20th century.
And I think that what happened was the funding got diverted in 1950 or something. So all the books had this wonderful kind of, you know, Depression era smell to them, and they were kept in this little corner of the library. And it was such a wonderful guilty pleasure to leave off the calculus and go up there and read, you know, For Whom the Bell Tolls. But I'm starting to think that it must just be neurological. You know, if you have an inclination towards language, and if reading text is the most alive you feel, just no matter where you start out, you're going to work your way back to that. And I could feel it happening when I was in Asia. You know, we'd be on the crew for a month uninterruptedly. It was like an hour helicopter ride from the nearest tiny little town. We were really in the middle of the Sumatran jungle. And so you'd load up this big bag with books in Singapore, and that was your lifeline for the next 4 weeks. So it's important that you choose wisely. And then come back with those books, and then kind of rushed through the workday so I could get back to my little room and just read. And I was reading Mailer, and I was reading Ulysses, and, you know, I mean, just completely Dickens and Atlas Shrugged. It didn't really matter.
Did you ever end up using that, as you say, rich material from the 80s in Sumatra in fiction?
Only in the sense that I tried and failed. I tried so hard when I was a grad student because I knew that had to be great material. You know, Sumatra, there's all this oil field trash from Oklahoma and Texas who'd never been out of Texas, and they're now in Sumatra with billions of dollars, basically, and there's transvestite bars, and, you know. But I, for some reason, don't work well with the literal. I don't know why it is. I think I just have a sort of dunderheaded you know, sensibility when I get around realism. So I did. I wrote about 2 books worth of stuff about that. But it was always kind of just what you'd expect. You know, Nick Adams goes to Sumatra.
You didn't go the whole Blade Runner, Philip K. Dick direction.
I mean, I think that's probably what I should have done. And maybe if I'd had those precedents in my mind, I could have done it. But now it's all got kind of a musty feeling to it. You know, I've written those stories, the bad stories, too many times to get out of it.
The first story in your new book imagines a mask that turns little babies babbling into fake grown-up speech in order to impress and entertain the adults around them. And you often invent products and things like that. Do you, with that, in that case, do you ever imagine that some marketing new product executive somewhere is going to go, hey, good idea?
Yeah. Well, if I can get a cut, that would be good. Now, that story just sometimes I – this is probably a dumb thing to admit, but I have these dreams that are very vivid, and they actually – they're dreams, but they've got a text with them almost. You know, literally I can hear the text.
Lucky you.
Yeah, well, every so often, like once every 4 years it happens. But that one was, I had a dream about this very wonderful woman I used to be involved with, and it didn't end well, mostly because I was putz. And so in the dream, she came to me and she said, I just want you to know it all worked out fine for me. I'm very happy. And I said, oh, that's great. It's terrific. She said, and not only that, I have a baby now. And I said, oh, I'm really happy. She goes, yeah, and my baby is really smart. And this baby came crawling in, and it was a very beautiful baby. And it started saying, you know, the primary cause of World War I was an internet. And I said, wow, that baby really is smart. And she was glowing, and everything was right with the world. And then I looked down, and there was a little zipper at the back of the baby's head. And I could see that it had this mask on. And the dream was just about, should I tell her? You know, should I break her heart. So you wake up from something like that, and it was sort of narrated in my mind. So I just got up and stumbled into the room and typed out the first couple paragraphs, and then I said, okay, that's, I can go from there, and then went back to bed.
That story is told from the point of view of a customer service guy writing to an unhappy customer.
Right.
At what point do you decide in a case like that, oh, that's the funny way to do it, or that's the more revealing way to do it?
That's a great question. I think it's just your gut. There was something about narrating that story from a third outside thing that made it less funny. And I also, you know, I just before I wrote that story, I just quit an engineering job that I'd worked for 7 or 8 years while writing my first book. And I knew that that's where the heat was, because I'd been in that situation so many times at my job. We were an engineering company, and often we'd be asked to write these public documents on behalf of some hazardous waste polluter. And it was always that sense of spinning something. You knew you were probably doing a not altogether honest thing, and you knew the diction in which you should do that, and you felt yucky about it, and yet your existence depended on it. And we did a lot of that kind of stuff. So somehow that tone was natural.
Can you read a bit from that story?
Sure. With the ICS 2100, you might choose to have Derek say or appear to say upon crawling into a room, "Here comes the Lovemeister," or "Stop talking dirty, the Lovemeister has arrived." How we do this is laser beams coming out of the earlobes, which sense the door frame. From its position on the head of Derek, the eye can speak knows it has just entered a room. And also you'll have over 100 discretionary phrases to more highly personalize Derek. You might choose to have Derek say on his birthday, for example, "Mommy and Daddy, remember that time you conceived me in Aruba?" Although probably you did not in fact conceive Derek in Aruba. That we do not know. Our research is not that extensive. Or say your dog comes up and gives Derek a lick. You might make Derek say, if your dog's name is Queenie, which our dog's name is Queenie, "Queenie, give it a rest." Which, you know what? Makes you love him more. Because suddenly he's articulate. Suddenly he's not just sitting there going glub, glub, glub while examining a piece of his own feces on his own thumb, which is something we recently found our Billy doing. Sometimes we've felt that our childless friends think badly of us for having a kid who just goes glub, glub, glub while looking at his feces on his thumb. But now, when childless friends come over, what we found, Ann and I, is that there's something great about having your kid say something witty and self-possessed years before he or she would actually, in reality, be able to say something witty or self-possessed. The bottom line is, it's just fun when you and your childless friends are playing cards and your baby suddenly blurts out in his very own probable future voice, "It is very possible that we still don't fully understand the import of all of Einstein's findings."
George Saunders reading from his story, I Can Speak, from his new collection of stories in Persuasion Nation, and doing a fantastic job with the special effects stunt voicing.
Thank you very much.
The sort of addiction, if you will, to in lots of your stories to buying and selling stuff, and forgive me, but the sense that it's a sort of soul corrosive set of acts. Do you see it as a corrosive thing?
I used to, and then I took a trip to Dubai. I wrote a piece for GQ about Dubai, and it occurred to me that it's corrosive in the same way that eating or sex. I mean, it's such a human desire to buy stuff and to surround yourself with cool things, and that in a certain way, it's a little bit. To me, it feels a little inadequate to say it's a bad thing.
You can eat too much, and I suppose
exactly.
You can have too much sex.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, no. But anyway, but I do think that's exactly right. That it's not so much the thing, but your relation to it. And now, having said that, I think in our time, somewhere around the time I was 13, religion started to fade in America. And the thing is, when you remove religion, it's not really replaced by humanism. It's kind of replaced by materialism. And I think that's where the corrosive part comes in. It's not as a sort of healthy part of a human life, buying and selling is wonderful. But I think maybe it seems to me in our time we've gotten a little bit – that's a new religion, and then it deserves to be kicked in the shins a little bit.
You wrote – or you said in an interview once that everything in the world is holy and unholy. What did you mean by that?
You know, there's a story I read about Tolstoy and Gorky. It sounds like a dirty joke, but it's actually true. They were walking through Moscow.
Russian walks into a bar.
Yeah, Russian into a bar. Hey, you got a duck? But they walk in, or they don't walk in. They're walking through Moscow, and these two hussars are coming towards them, these strapping young guys in high boots. And Tolstoy, he's at this point 700 years old, you know, and celibate. He says, that's everything that's wrong with Russia. The arrogance, the macho, the idea that their way is the only way, the physical force, it's our doom. It's our history and it's our doom. And Gorky's like, wow, I never thought of it that way. You're absolutely right. And these two kids walk by in the smell of cologne and the clanking sabers. And little Tolstoy turns on his heels and says, on the other hand, that's everything wonderful about Russia. You know, the action in the world and the passion and the belief that they can make a difference. And again, Gorky is convinced. And so I've been thinking about that the last couple of years. That's not a bad model for art, that everything is true and false at once. And maybe the artist is like the Shakespearean moron who just says everything at once and kind of stirs things up and then just, you know, walks away.
I mentioned earlier the story about teenagers, older children, whose brains have been wired for effective test marketing. And I'd love it if you could read a short section from that and set up for us what is going on.
So this narrator of the story is this kid named John who has this device in his neck that you mentioned. And here he's the true love of his life is this woman named Carolyn, and they've been separated. She's decided to get out of this whole thing, had the thing removed, and now here he's going to see her again for the first time. Looking out, I saw no walls and no rug and no ceiling, only lawn and flowers, and above that, a wide black sky with stars, which all of that made me a little dizzy, there being no glass between me and it. Then Slippin' very gently pushed me out. And I don't know, it's one thing to look out a window, but when you are out, actually out, that is something very powerful. And how embarrassing was that, because I could not help it, I went down flat on my gut, checking out those flowers, and the feeling of the one I chose was like the silk in that Hermes jacket I could never seem to get reserved because Vance was always hogging it. Except the flower was even better, it being very smooth and built in like layers, with the outside layer being yellow, and inside that a white thing like a bell, and inside the white bell-like thing were 15, I counted, smaller bell-like red things, and inside each red thing was an even smaller orange two dingly thing combo, which I was like, dude, who thought this up? And though I knew very well from religion it was God, still I had never thought so high of God as I did just then, seeing the kind of stuff he could do when he put his or her mind to it.
George Saunders, thanks very much for coming into Studio 360.
Thank you so much for having me.
George Saunders' new collection of stories, In Persuasion Nation, is in bookstores right now.
Coming up next, You've heard Kat Russell's voice in the background of more pop songs than you can count. Now she's front and center. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.